I want winners. I want people that want to win.
Rod, we had said we were going to go live on Thursday night after the game. And I think in hindsight, us not going live on Thursday was probably for the best, because I was so spent after watching a full game and overtime, the ups and downs, the, oh my gosh, the Niners are going to blow this one again feeling, and then the jubilation of them actually pulling it out. I think I needed to take a breather there, or else I don't know what that podcast would have been on Thursday night.
Yeah, I wasn't feeling my best. So it was interesting, kind of. I actually finished watching the game at Quick Care. So yeah, it was not a great night, but it was. I still, in thinking about it now, I still don't know how. I'm absolutely ecstatic that they won that game.
Yeah,
but I don't know. It was a roller coaster, like you say, because there was so many, you know, ultimately they got the win, and that's great. But then there were so many other things that, and I guess I need to stop that as a fan and just be a fan. But I'm like, when we stink in the red zone, we're still not getting any pass rush. I mean, there's all these other things that I was just so happy they got the win, because I could just see the narrative of how they just pissed it away and let it get away. But they didn't,
you know.
And that is kind of starting to be that's what this team is being, you know, is showing, is a lot of resilience.
Yeah, last year they would have lost this game. Last year, lose this game. They lost a version of this game so many times. And I don't know what the difference is between last year and this year. Some of it may just be luck. Some of it may just be the other team kind of having to make hard decisions that end up, you know, and we can discuss these overtime scenarios, because I'm still confused as to what these teams should do in overtime. Last year, yeah, they would have lost this game. You know, there was a game in LA where it was very much like this. They had an early lead and then they just kind of gave it away at the end. And this time it felt that way going into the fourth quarter. I was like, okay, they showed guts and they played great for three quarters. They're probably going to lose this. They keep giving Stafford the ball. Every time Stafford has the ball, I'm just scared out of my mind. And they're able to hold on. Some of it, we'll talk about some of the strategy on both teams late in the game. One worked out for the Niners, even though Niners fans were going nuts. And the other did not work out for McVay, even though I think Niners fans were petrified that they were just going to score a touchdown and win the game. So, let's talk about Mac, because Mac is the big story, and it should be of no surprise to anybody who has been a 49ers fan for any amount of years. But quarterbacks not only rule in the NFL, but historically here in the Bay Area, they are always the talk of the town. When you have Montana and Young, and you have Cap and Alex Smith and Jimmy G, the quarterbacks are the superstars. They're the, you know, they're the movie stars of sports teams out here in the Bay Area, so much so that really only Steph Curry can kind of get onto the 49ers quarterback level when it comes to stardom. And so obviously Brock is hurt last week, even though they went into that game saying Brock's going to be fine. It's the toe's not problematic when he throws. He then, I don't know if he re-injures it or if it's just kind of this lingering injury that's going to stay with him all year. We'll sort of see how that plays out. As you know, I am not very trustworthy when it comes to the 49ers and their injury reports. And so Mac gets another opportunity to play on this big stage. Now, the narrative going into the game is that it's the 49ers and the preseason squad against the Rams, and the Rams should kind of beat them up. But Shanahan and McVay know each other very well, so it'll probably be close, and Shanahan will be trying to out-scheme McVay even more so than ever, because he knows that his troops are light on some of the best players on his team. And Mac comes out, and I've not seen a ton of Mac Jones play football, but this dude was so confident in his decision-making early on. So I don't know if they had watched so much tape that he knew what these Rams defenders were going to do, because he was throwing these passes as if he was like an expert on the Rams defense. And I thought right away, I was like, man, this dude is just ripping this ball down the field like he knows where every little chess piece is for the Niners and for the Rams. And so as you're watching, he's kind of coming up hobbling, and you know, this dude is a professional athlete. It didn't seem like it was very hot in the stadium. I don't know how this man is cramping up. He was
cramping. Mm-hmm.
And so maybe it's just the high level of the game. And, you know, in the NFL, this is probably the biggest game he's ever played in his career, as far as, you know, what it means to be on a winning team and to play against the other winning team. But he's just hanging in there, and he's still kind of like being his own self personally. You know, I see him like baiting the defenders and dancing around them and stuff. And, you know, that's why I call him Mac Daddy Jones. He's got this vibe to him. But that was such a great, like, not only, you know, we talk about the idea of like being a game manager, and there was a lot of that, you know, because he did not have their top receivers on the field. He was throwing to Kendrick Bourne as their number one receiver. But at the same time, he was not afraid to take chances on some of the bigger hits. And I just found it fascinating, because on one end, we have Brock, and Brock is, a lot of times, he's trying to create scenarios where they can make big plays, even if there's only a sliver of a chance for the defense. The interception to CMC last week was Brock saying, I thought we had an opportunity to actually score on this play, so I threw that pass with the intention that there's risk there, but if we hit it, Christian is probably scoring a touchdown. And so that's his mentality. And we've talked about this all offseason, which is last year Brock even professed to saying, I was trying to do too much, and now I've learned from that. Has he learned from that? Who knows? But I think there's also the pressure of him being their highest paid player. He needs to play to that level. Well, the pressure on Mac is the opposite. The pressure on Mac is he is there to be the backup, and if he can make some coin for himself a la Sam Darnold, then it's just, that's the pie in the sky for him. So it's just this interesting thing with the 49ers and their quarterbacks. You know, as we've said in the past, everybody's favorite player is the backup quarterback. It's just how it works in the NFL. There's like optimism for the backup quarterback that doesn't exist for the starter in some cases. And you've watched Mac play in college. What was going through your mind as you were watching this dude shred up the Rams defense? Like, did you think, man, this guy should be a starter in the NFL as long as he's got the coaching and, you know, maybe a Kyle Shanahan influence? Or were you just like, you know, the Rams were kind of taking this game lightly? Like, how did you feel while you were watching Mac dice these guys up?
He really looked great. And then Friday morning, Saban co-signs that, you know, that's the best Mac Jones has ever looked, and he won a national championship with Mac Jones. So that's first, is that Mac has never looked this good. And what's interesting to me is, you know, like you say, the 49er fans, the most popular guy in the city is always going to be the backup quarterback. But the reality of the situation is there are 181 reasons why it doesn't matter how well Mac Jones plays. Brock Purdy is our quarterback. Yeah. That's just what it is.
Mac even said that in the post game.
Right. I mean, this is so, and he's playing like it. So there's literally no pressure on him, because no matter how he plays, there's not a scenario where a healthy Brock Purdy is benched for Mac Jones. It's just from a business standpoint, from a team standpoint, for a lot of reasons. I mean, we can go back to as far as, you know, basically Brock saved everybody's job. They went all in on Trey. Shit doesn't work. They hit on him. And if they don't find a reasonable solution to the Trey Lance problem, I don't know that either Lynch or Shanahan are here right now. So you got that. And then you've paid him. So now it's just from, you know, you hear fans, or I see fans talking about Mac 10 and how, you know, these ridiculous. Number one, even with all that he's done, he has shown himself to be a capable backup quarterback. Maybe, you know, one of the best backup situations in the league. It's completely different when you're the man. So when you talk about going down that same road of Geno or Baker or Sam Darnold, again, that will be another question. Brock, I mean, Mac is playing well right now. If in a year, you know, if they decide to keep him and he plays the next year out and then becomes a free agent, or they trade him somewhere, I think Kyle Shanahan is right. Mac has shown that he is probably one of the best 32 quarterbacks in the league. I don't know where an opportunity for him would show up, but if he were to get that opportunity and he got $30 million like Sam Darnold, the pressure is different than it is right now when you're the man now and you are being paid like the man. Like, just like we've seen here, everything was great for Brock when he was the little engine that could. Mm-hmm. But now all of a sudden that he is the $181 million man, fans have changed. A lot of the fan base has changed with their expectations of who and what he should be and is. And that just comes with it. So I find that interesting. He's played really well. If I had to tell the truth, I went into this game waiting for the carriage to turn into a pumpkin, but it obviously didn't. And he played really well. And I would add Kendrick Bourne into that mix too. I mean, I've never seen him play as well. I mean, obviously it was a career high in both receptions and yards for him. But yeah, they really played well, especially in the first half. Things kind of got a little wonky in the second half, and especially in the fourth quarter. But overall, you know, those were, you know, great performances by those two specifically. And shout out to the pass protection as well.
Yeah.
Only 16 pressures. You know, our guy McKivitz didn't have a great night, but the rest of the offensive line really played well. And when I thought that would be a play, you know, I'd watched the game last week against the Colts. They pressured Daniel Jones 25 times and only got, you know, he put 16 pressures on Mac. So, yeah, that was a pleasant surprise.
There was a moment early in the game where I don't even remember what the play was, but like, Connor Colby like almost did like a 360 and he couldn't find out who he was supposed to block. And I was like, oh no, this is going to be bad. And
yeah,
it really wasn't bad. I mean, Mac was getting hit late, but I think some of that was he was looking for some bigger shots and they would have to bring in McCaffrey to kind of at least help stop a little bit. And then McCaffrey couldn't get out in time for Mac to throw that little dump off in some cases. And so he had to hold the ball a little bit longer. Now, I told you that I was going to watch the Amazon broadcast on their next gen stats screen.
Yes.
And so I was only going to watch the first quarter, and then I was going to switch back to the normal broadcast. But they were up 14-0, and I was like, maybe I should just stay with this one. And so I watched it the whole way. That is an interesting way to watch football. I don't know if
it looks like a video game.
It looks like a video game. It's like, so the way that I would describe it is, if you were to let's say you're behind the quarterback, and that's your view. And now, kind of go above and kind of like if you're like a helicopter, like looking down on the field. That's kind of the view of the what you can see. So it's kind of hard to see like players. So instead, they have these little circles around the players that you should definitely pay attention to. And then they have the names and everything. So you see this, you see what happens. And then they will sometimes, when they have a good prediction, they will predict when the blitzes are coming. But they have like these little pieces of information that pop up on the screen. And the one that I thought was the most interesting is, and we'll talk about the overtime rules in a second, but so fourth and one in overtime.
Mm-hmm.
And the next gen stat said, if it's fourth and two or less, they should go for it. Because if they kick the field goal here, the Niners still have 3 minutes and change to get back into field goal range to then win the game. And so I'm like, oh, wow, it's fourth and one. And I'm like thinking, man, I wonder what McVay's going to. And immediately he goes for it. And I'm like, man, the having that information on the screen gave me so much like thought on what he was going to do. And they have this guy pop up in this little bubble, and he's trying to explain certain scenarios like in quick time. And so they pause the play-by-play, or actually they mute it, and then this guy comes on, and then they get back into the play-by-play. And that was pretty seamless. Like, you didn't hear them like cut in at the wrong time or anything. So I thought that was really cool. But where it was best was you could actually see coverage mistakes. So what I was doing, I was just mostly trying to find Puka. Every time the Rams had the ball, I was like, okay, I want to find Puka, and I want to see what they're doing to get him open. And a lot of it, like, Davante Adams was the greatest decoy in this game. I don't know how many catches he had. I remember him making a couple. But they were just putting Davante and Puka right next to each other. And Davante would just run interference so that Puka could skate free, and then he would be open, and then they would throw him the ball. There were moments where, and I think they may have even explained this on the broadcast, but the Niners were in man, and that's the other thing that they predict, is they predict whether the defense is in man or zone. And so the Niners are in man, and the guy, I don't even remember who it was, the guy who was assigned to Puka was actually still playing zone. And so you watch all of the defense move except for one guy. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, and Fred is pissed. Fred is like jumping up and down. like, what are you doing? So watching it from that point of view was actually really interesting, because you could see the field open up, and it's like playing Madden, where when you play the video game, you're looking for pockets in the defense for your receivers to cut in so that you can throw the ball. And what it did is it just gave me so much more like just respect for what the QB does, because also in that mode, you're counting down, or I was at least, I was counting down the seconds in my head, because I could see the pass rush as Mac saw it in a pulled back view, but I could see how close these guys were getting to Mac before he had to decide to throw the ball. And then as he throws the ball, the camera doesn't pan away from the quarterback. So you're seeing him throw it. You're seeing him get hit. You're seeing the receiver catch it. And so you're seeing everything. And it was like a kind of a scary, nervous way to watch the game, because I'm just assuming that Mac is getting drilled on every play. And obviously he doesn't. But there were some moments where they would show in the replay where you could tell that some of those Rams defenders were like yeah, we know that who's on the bench here, Adrian Martinez. This dude does not want to come into this game. And so they would do the thing where they're rushing and I forgot, maybe it was Verse, like, would just two-hand shove Mac and then do the thing where he pulls his hands back as if he didn't touch him. I'm like, dude, you just shoved this dude right in front of the referee. And they kept that call clean. You know, they didn't call a roughing there. They called roughing once. And then there was another time where I forget who the defender was, but he collapses on top of Mac. And then
that was Young.
And then he's pulling his hands back as if to say, I didn't do anything wrong. But what it does is it puts more weight on Mac in that moment. And I was like, oh my gosh, just watching this view just makes the quarterback position seem even harder to play. So my respect level went
that
up.
That was definitely a roughing.
Yeah, I
that
thought was so a too. Roughing. I thought sure. so too. But like there's a, I'd hate to call it a gamesmanship, but the Rams knew who was on the bench. They knew that the second they got Mac out of that game, you're basically bringing in a deer in headlights to try and play this. So they're being a little bit rougher with Mac. And it, look, the intensity of that game was the intensity of a playoff game. That was no week five game for those two teams. That was that was almost near playoff intensity, which, you know, it made it even more exciting. So are you like, when you're watching these overtime rules and strategy, are you convinced that you know that the coaches know what they're doing in these moments?
I have no idea. I don't. Because it's not like a lot of things in an analytics world where the decisions are clear cut, that if it's this, then you do that. Like I haven't been able to get a clear, I heard arguments on both sides in terms of, you know, whether you take the ball or not, you know, in overtime, whether you want the ball first or whether you want to, you know, so there's not a consensus on any of it.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it interesting. And no, I don't think they know what they're going to do. From time to time, when you know, from decision to decision.
I was watching it and thinking, obviously going back to the Super Bowl that we lost because of, and there was a lot of conversation about the strategy of whether the Niners want the ball or they don't want the ball, you know, that whole thing. And so, the Niners, by getting the ball first, as long as they can prevent the Rams from scoring a touchdown, so they kick the field goal. We'll talk about Latino Heat, Eddie Pinheiro, in a bit. But so they kick the field goal, and that puts pressure on McVay to either score a field goal and leave time on the clock, or to go for the touchdown. And by going for the touchdown, you essentially go for the win. So there's a strategy there that is pretty interesting. There's another strategy that I didn't even think of until the Niners had a very promising drive in overtime, which is, what happens if they like use up 9 minutes of that clock before kicking the field goal? Do the Rams only have 1 minute to tie the game?
Yep.
That's wild to me because of this idea that you have to give both teams a chance. And so I don't know if 10 minutes is the right amount of time. Like, I wonder if...
Well,
go ahead.
That was one of the reasons the week before, with the game that ended in a tie, was it seemed like that's what LaFleur was doing. Was he was playing defense against the Cowboys getting the ball back and having enough time to put Aubrey in position for a field goal, because, you know, he is the Terminator in terms of, so right. Literally, if you get the ball, if they get the ball on the 35 or 40, they're like a field goal. They're like a first down away from being in field goal range for him. So it was like that was part, rather than trying to win the game, they were trying to milk clock so that if they kicked the field goal, he would not have a chance to, you know, beat them, which is to kind of play for the tie, in essence, is a wild notion because of the field goal kicker, nonetheless.
Yeah, I wonder if the way to do this is like no clock on the first two drives, and then if by the time the team gets their third chance, then it's like 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, because it's just like these teams are so smart, they're gonna know every single possible advantage and unique opportunity to not lose the game. And so what the NFL wants is, you know, for years and years and years it was just sudden death, and so a lot of times the team who gets the kickoff, they can just kick a 45-yard field goal and win, and the game's over. And people were saying, well, that's unfair because the other team doesn't get an opportunity. And so now we have this equal opportunity overtime, and yet we're still seeing similar strategies to ice the game and we'd rather tie than lose. And I don't think that they figured it out. What do you think of the college rule, by the way, of how they do this?
I really don't love it. I want it, however, I guess I don't love ties, but I want it to be football. I don't want it to be, you know, I don't want it to be a field goal kicking contest necessarily. I don't want it to be like, you know, like soccer and like me or hockey with like penalty shot. I don't want it to be that. I want it to be as close to football as possible. And I just don't think that putting the ball on the 25 and saying, okay, this is that, just especially, I don't think that definitely doesn't work for the NFL, because kicking has gotten better in college, but a 30-yard field goal in college is not nearly as automatic as, you know, hell, we live in a world now in the NFL where 60-yard field goals are like legitimate. I mean, these guys are making them like they're nothing. Like our guy, Eddie, I didn't know 59 was on the board.
That's probably good from like 63, 64, the way he kicked it.
Yeah. And I thought that was something that we had sacrificed when we let Moody go, was that, okay, we know that Pinheiro is going to come in here and he's going to be accurate, obviously, you know, fourth highest make rate in history. But I didn't think that, you know, 50 plus was going to be, would be even something we would even try. I didn't know that would be on the board. And like you say, that was good from 60. I mean, 63, 62. And so I think that really adds to the drama of this in terms of the decision making and overtime, when, you know, 50 plus, when 60 plus is on the board, yeah, it just, you know, it makes the decision making that much murkier.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is so, like, I don't know, like, you know, if the NFL, the rules committee, like they like to change small rules all the time. Rules that they want to test, you know, the kickoff rule. Actually, that's not actually a small rule. The kickoff thing is a pretty big thing. But I would be interested if they look into the field goal thing as a, okay, we need to figure out how to, like, when you can return a kickoff to the other team's 45 and have a legitimate opportunity to just kick from there and win the game, like, that's crazy to me. You don't even have to go barely past midfield. So I don't know what they get paid the big bucks to figure that stuff out, but the kicker,
well, I don't,
all of a sudden is super important to this game.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you feel about the kickoff change, because they have definitely, if what they were striving to do was to bring the kickoff back in, the return back into the game, they've definitely done that with the rule changes. And then now with this thing of the landing zone, it is, if you miss the landing zone, to the point we were just discussing about with these long field goals, getting the ball on the 40 is extremely punitive for the defense, because you are, again, you're 2 feet, you're two first downs away from a field goal decision.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you get the ball on the 40, that is, and like when in these close games and your kicker misses the landing zone, it is devastating that now that you've given up 20 yards in field position because he didn't kick it inside. So it's like, I noticed this weekend, that was last weekend, that was a thing, that when in these tight games, they're just, rather than messing around, a lot of teams just kick it into the end zone, just kick it rather than, you know, risking, like my guy did. He has been so, Cardi has been so good at that dirty kick, and he missed the landing zone and gave Mac, you know, field position to, I mean, it has made the kickoff, it's a play that's important now.
Yeah,
you know, when it seemed like they were trying to legislate it out of the game.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago.
He brought back the squib kick, the old Ray Wershing squib kick from the 1981 Super Bowl. Ray Wershing couldn't do that in the league today, because he would bounce that thing way in front of the 20. I think some of these are, I don't know if these are big, huge swings of what it means to the game, but when you have an outlier like the Dallas kicker, at some point that it, like, let's say that Dallas is not good this year, by the way, so this is not going to be that big of a deal. But let's say that Dallas gets good, or let's say that he goes to a different team. Now, you put him on the Buffalo Bills, and Josh Allen literally only has to gain 25 to 30 yards on a drive, and you got an easy 3 points every single time. Like, that's adding steroids to, like, a crazy offense, right? So I think in that case, like if we had that example of the best team in the league weaponizing somebody like that, I think there would probably be a little bit more talk about it. But because Dallas is garbage this year, it's probably not going to be that big of a topic. But like you said, we thought Latino Heat was just going to be like, okay, anything in the range of, you know, 30 to 45, he's money, and we'll take it. That's what Robbie Gould was for us.
Right.
We'll take it. We just need to get there. We're not going to worry about anything beyond that. Kyle hates setting up for field goals as it is. But when this man can kick a 59-yard field goal, clutch, necessary field goal, I can't remember, like, what 49ers kicker in past history could even reach that distance? Could Joe Nedney kick a 60-yarder?
Not even. Now, and when you talk about the fact that they're on bad teams, but the kicker for both Dallas and, you know, or the guy in Cincinnati, he kicked one from 70 in preseason.
Yeah,
that's absurd. I mean, so for set, you know, and I guess Aubrey has done that several times, you know, in preseason as well.
How much of it has to do with these special kicker balls that they have?
Exactly. Now, again, it was my understanding is that that's what people feel about guys like Pinheiro, is that it's the fact that they're able to work the balls that made that possible, that for them to even attempt it, is that, you know, they work the balls, and the ball has made that You know, it's kind of like they juice the balls like they did in baseball for the home runs.
Oh, wow.
That's an interesting thing, is that, you know, will that be a simple fix that they just go back to, well, you know, no more K balls. They're just, you know, just use the regular balls that everybody else uses.
I feel like Tom Brady had to break some cell phones because of cooking footballs.
And now they're doing it legally.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on. Talk a little bit more about the game here. So I thought one of the interesting things, again, I don't know if I would have thought about it this way if I watched it from the normal broadcast, but the 49ers and the Rams, they each had their safety valve in that their best player was given the opportunity to make plays constantly. On one side, you had Puka Nacua, who he just seems like he's open every single time, and he could take any sort of, like, it's 7, 8, 10. Like, it just seems open every single play if they wanted it. And on the flip side, the Rams fans had to sort of think about it the same way from the point of view of Christian. Like, the same, like, our going like, hey, man, can we cover Puka here? They had to be thinking the same thing about Christian coming out of the backfield. And if you look at the numbers from both guys, this was really interesting. So Puka Nacua, 10 catches for 85 yards and one touchdown. He had a long of 16. He was targeted 12 times. Interestingly, according to the ESPN stats, Devontae Adams was targeted 11 times, but he only had 5 catches. And some of those were big plays late. And then Kyren Williams out of the backfield targeted 10 times. He had 8 catches. The flip side, Christian, 8 catches, 82 yards. So he actually did a better Puka impersonation from a production standpoint than even Puka had in that game. And then obviously CMC's running the ball. 2.6 yards a carry. Brian Robinson, 2.4 yards a carry. As a team, they ran the ball 33 times for 74 yards. So Everything that we said last week about all of the reasons why they can't run the football, they were exposed in a big way on Thursday night because they literally could not run the football. And yet they're still able to pull that game out. And on the flip side, the Rams ran it much better, but they didn't run it nearly as much as the Niners did. So this came down to me to the opportunity that the Niners offense had. Rams were a little bit more quick scoring, bigger chunks down the field. And the Niners played this real grinded out, extend the possession, time of possession game. The Niners had 66 plays to the Rams. 82 plays to the Rams, 61 plays. So that is a crazy difference. And I guess that explains how you can only average 2.5 yards per carry and still move the ball down the field, because your passing game is all about picking up the yardage that your running game can't pick up. So I thought that was interesting. But just the idea that CMC and Puka were kind of mirrors of each other offensively, I thought that was a fascinating thing to watch, you know, from both sides, from the Rams side and from the Niners side.
Well, and to me, it's of note, because I think as we move forward, if you can, the touches that you want to get CMC, because it's just, you know, it's just a fact that receiving touches and rushing touches aren't the same thing. You definitely would prefer him touching the ball as a receiver more than he does as a running back, just from a usage and protection standpoint. And it's going to be interesting to see if how that works out, if we aren't able to be more efficient running the ball. Because again, I understand and I hear the calls for giving Brian Robinson more touches, but I don't think that that's anything that other teams are going to really fear. You mm-hmm. have to hand Christian the ball a certain number of times for them to try to at least kind of keep them honest.
Yes.
And then I know it's something that it seems like just for a lot of reasons previously, Kyle has not wanted to do, but I would say, and then I don't, as I say it, I'm thinking that maybe the toe makes that not a viable option anymore. But if you, it looks like, you know, we've got a viable backup in Mac. It would be great that if he was healthy and you could incorporate Brock more into the run game, because he's athletic enough when mm-hmm. healthy that, you know, some of the RPO stuff would definitely be on the table. But, you know, who knows with this toe and how that's just, it's always seemed to me like, you know, they said, you know, they were talking about 1 week for Brock and then he comes back and now he's out again. Where, and again, I know that those turf toes, they're a strain and they're grades to them and whatnot. But like Burrow was out like, they like 3 months surgery yeah. from off the rip. So again, it will be interesting to see how they move forward now. So they've got the 10 days between now and their next game. And, you know, is Brock coming back? Or will they give him another week? Or, you know, because like I'm not a person at all. I'm not drinking that Kool-Aid that I think that, I mean, if they sign off on Brock and he's healthy, legitimately healthy, and he wants, and he has to be legitimately healthy. I'm not going to say just because he wants to go out there, because he's a competitor
yep.
and he'll go out there at 60%. So you can't, somebody has to be the adult in
and,
the room.
And you know what?
On that.
He understands this narrative of being the backup quarterback, being the favorite player on the team better than anybody. Like he knows yeah. Mac
absolutely.
Playing well is great for the team, but also because the 49ers are, you know, one of the, I mean, you see how many fans that they had in that stadium. They're one of the bigger teams in the league. And so now Brock had to go through the highs of, oh my gosh, this seventh round pick is playing at an elite level, to, is Brock really good? To, okay, you had to pay Brock like he's a top five quarterback. Is he that? And now he's got Mac on his heels. So he understands the conversation around this position in the NFL better than anybody. So, of course, he's going to want to play and prove himself. This is what drives him as a human being.
That's exactly. There was a comment at one point, I guess, going into the Cardinal game. No, going into the Jags game that, somebody made the comment that Kyle would have to convince, you know, Purdy to play. And like, you have no idea about the kind of competitor this guy is. If you think that somebody's going to have to convince him to play, you have to tie him to the bench
yeah.
To keep him from playing if it's not within his best interest is the read that I have on this guy. I have him as a alpha predator competitor. Yeah. He is, so that is the concern, is that, you know, not to bring him back too fast, because like you say, he wants feel, because he should not, but I can say that, I can sit here and say that, but because he should not have to feel like he's got anything to prove, I don't think.
Yeah.
But I know being the competitor he is, he would definitely probably feel that way, that, you know, he's got to earn this money and he's got to, you know, lead his team and all of that, which I respect. But, you know, like I say, he's got 181 million reasons why this should be a long term play. We shouldn't be worried about, you know, what's going to happen against Tampa Bay. That if that is the only consideration that we're making, we are not looking at this in a logical way. We need to be, you know, looking at the end game and in terms of like, if this is real, which we can discuss, because I've got thoughts. If this whole thing is real, then we need to be thinking about January and not, you know, week six. So, yeah.
So I was kind of hopeful. And, you know, we always want our guys to come back. But I was like, man, can Kittle get back by Tampa Bay? Because Tampa Bay is kind of another prove it game to where we will try and figure out if the Niners are real or not, because Tampa is not a walkover in any way. Baker's playing crazy football, the kind of football that if you watch some of the coverage stuff, as I did from that vantage point, Stafford was eating these dudes up. Just like
problematic and no pressure.
None.
No pressure.
And so, you know, and there were moments where you could tell, like, I think on one of the touchdowns, they brought two blitzes at the same time and the timing was off and Stafford was like, huh? Like right there? Like, I'm just going to throw this thing to Kyron and he's going to walk in the end zone. And like, there were moments like that where I was like, okay, they realize that this is going to be tough. And it's not like Stafford is fleet footed back there. He's a statue and you still can barely touch him. But yeah, so it sounds like no Kittle on Tampa. They're hoping that the following week will be Kittle. So still, we're going to basically run this back depending on whether or not it's going to be Brock or Mac. And then I guess Kalia Davis got hurt in that game. Somebody else got hurt, which leads to Alfred Collins, of all people, making the single biggest play of the game. Kyron Williams ready to go for the touchdown to kind of ice this thing. And
it was a great play.
He strips this dude at the goal line and the Niners pick up the ball. You know, I just want to go slightly off tangent here. Al Michaels is maybe the GOAT to me of play-by-play broadcasters. I mean, you can go all the way back to the 70s with Al Michaels. This man needed some help on this game. He did not see that fumble. And then the other play that he got confused on was on the roughing the passer early in the game. He got so confused about whether that was a penalty on the Niners or the Rams. So I'm sure it was because somebody's feeding him information from the side.
Right.
And he's getting confused. And I felt bad for this guy because one of the savviest broadcasters ever, and he's struggling with like stuff that is happening right in front of him. And so he has no idea that this ball is out. And I'm watching it going like, okay, what is this chaos? Like obviously something happened because, or else Kyron should be walking into the end zone. So it's either down on the one or the way the Niners defense is reacting, we got the football. And it took Al like 3 seconds to figure out what had happened there. And I was like, oh, I feel so bad for this guy. By the way, his book came out in mid 2010s. I listened to the audio version and he narrates it. It's awesome. So if anyone is a fan of broadcasting, that book is good. So on this play, Alfred Collins steps up and I was surprised to hear his name. I was like, Alfred Collins, like how, why? And then I remembered, okay, Khalil Davis got hurt. So Alfred Collins, who the story of Alfred Collins in the preseason was the Niners signed him or they drafted him and they were going to really take advantage of his talents. And the story in training camp was he's just behind everybody else. He holds out because he's a second round pick. And there's like this thing with between first and second rounders, which is like this gap of pay. So all the second rounders held out. And he's one of those guys, finally gets signed. And the story is that he's just a step behind everybody. And they excuse that, you know, some of it was, oh, because of the signing thing. But I hadn't even really heard his name. Even in the preseason, they were saying that he was kind of disappointing even playing against the backups. And so to hear his name, to see him make this play, some of it was just the idea that he had an opportunity because of the injuries, But the other thing that, and, you know, looking at it from an optimistic viewpoint is, man, can he, you know, is he going to play more? And could he be some of these young players who are both, they're trying to progress and get better, while at the same time also being part of the current team? They have to play because of all these injuries, and because they spend big, you know, it's a stars and scrubs mentality that we kind of talked about, the fantasy football way that the Niners put this roster together. Like, Alfred Collins, could he be somebody on this team? Like, is this an opportunity where he takes advantage of it? And all of a sudden, like you're saying, in January, Alfred Collins is making big plays from the defensive line.
You would hope so, because, you know, if you look at, you know, I think that the PFF grades are legit. Our young guys did not have great games this year. None of them. What I was shocked to see is how poorly D Winters graded out today. On Friday. It was on Thursday. It was not good. He was targeted 11 times and gave up 9 catches, which is his, that's his thing. But, you know, on the flip side of that, you know, that's the curse of being so good in coverage. If you end up on Puka Boy, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah. It was the tight end too. He kept getting matched up on the tight end. And
who was supposed to be a replacement for Higbee, their number one tight end is down. So this guy is like a backup, and he had a really pretty good game.
Stafford is throwing the ball with D Winters' head kind of turned around, and he just had no chance because Stafford's the magic man when it comes to stuff like that. Like, this tight end was just running a simple route, and what actually made him open versus not open is Stafford was able to see where Winters was specifically, and then he was throwing it to where only the tight end could get to the football. And Winters looked really confused on many of those plays. And that's not to say that Stafford hasn't done that to other people before, but that was where he was kind of on an island.
And that's the thing. Another thing, we talk about the pressures, in that obviously Saleh does not like to blitz, but he has shown a willingness to blitz. But you really can't blitz Matt Stafford. I mean, it's, you know, because like you say, on the touchdown, they came with a blitz, and Matt Stafford knew exactly where to go with the ball. Because the blitzer, that was Williams' guy. Yeah. And so that is maybe something as we move forward that, you know, he will be able to maybe blitz a little more than he was. But, you know, you get these 15, 16, 17 year players, they've seen everything twice. So, I mean, it's just not, you know, you're not, you know, he's, you know, Stafford is at that Brady level in terms of having seen everything. So you're not going to fool him with a blitz. So yeah, it's going to be interesting as we move forward. I think, unless you've got something else, I'd like to hear your thoughts on, do you think that this, how real do you think this 4-1 is?
I guess it sort of depends on whether you think winning these tough games and, you know, eking them out is luck or tide turning or toughness or grit, you know, whatever these adjectives you can use to describe. All I know is last year they were losing all of these games for whatever reason. Does that mean this team is mentally tougher? Does that mean this team is better coached? Does that mean that they're taking advantage of other things? That's the hard part for me, but I looked it up. They have won their games. Their 4 wins are by a total of 5 points, 4 points, 1 point, 3 points. Those are their wins. Not a lot of wiggle room there in those wins, but that helps you get into the playoffs. And I think the game that, so Seattle always tough, especially in Seattle. The home game against Arizona is the one that kind of makes me second guess whether this is real or not. Now, Arizona is probably about as average as a team who then plays up against the Niners all the time. That's kind of what the story has been. I would like to see what happens when they play a team like Arizona again or Seattle at home, because if they can put some distance between those two teams, then maybe it's really just all about getting your guys back and being able to take advantage of the tough wins where I think, and I think when you get these tough wins, I think that is sort of built into your confidence. Whereas maybe even last year, when you keep losing these games, you sort of think about it from the perspective of, oh man, we're up three with 5 minutes left and they're driving. We've lost this game like three times already. And I do wonder if that kind of gets in the psyche of both the coaching and the playing. But I think it's kind of an, I think I would give them an incomplete grade as far as whether they're real or not, because I want to see Kittle back. I want to see if they get anything from Ayuk. Obviously you want Brock back. Bosa being gone, that's going to hurt. Their defense does not look fantastic in any way, shape, or form, even in these games where they're not giving up a ton of points. They are able to make big stops in opportune times, but I'm not confident that they're able to stop teams up and down from going up and down the field. I mean, when Trevor Lawrence is able to pick you apart for a lot of the game, and it just seems like he's just trying to get the ball out quick. That did not give me a lot of confidence in what the defense could do. And you know, Stafford. He's one of the best. But he still threw for like 380 yards, and they ran the ball well, which is the other thing. Which is, did he even need to throw that much, or did they just not trust Kyren with the football? So I would say, I would give it an incomplete grade only because I want to see what happens when they get some of these guys back. And I'll caveat that with, at the same time, you can get a Kittle back, but the way that the last two seasons have gone, getting a Kittle back means you're going to lose somebody else, because that's just kind of been the rhythm of the team. Jake Tonjes is, people may start paying a little bit more attention to him, you know, as he makes these plays. We need Kittle back. We need BA back. We need Jennings. We need Ricky. But I do think there's something to the character of the team when you can actually win a game like this when all of your dudes are gone. Because, you know, and look, if this was not the Rams, if this was a rando team that Shanahan, you know, is not a rival of, and that the Niners historically, you know, going into LA, I'm sure that helped. They're very confident playing in that building. You know, if it was the Carolina Panthers against this beat up 49ers, they probably don't play as well as they did. But I think there was something to just knowing your rival, being the underdog, feeling disrespected. You know, you heard the quote where Shanahan was pissed off about how many points they were the underdog. And Mac was like, yep, me too. And Shanahan was like, man, just let it rip. Like, that was like the conversation that the two guys had. I think some of that plays into how they felt about this game. But yeah, give me like three more weeks, and I think I'll feel a lot better about how I feel about them. But 4-1, this is like the perfect way to start this season with all the injuries and all the issues with this roster.
Well, you definitely build a cushion. I know the two things that I come away with is that, one, I don't know how anybody could have any questions about Kyle and his play calling, because he has made some great calls in the clutch. And then I would say the same thing about Saleh. If the game is close and he needs to dial up something like the last play this week, the Saints play, I would say the week before with Nick ending the game, that might have been more of an individual play than it was a call. But he, when the game is on the line, can make defensive calls that can get stops. That's unequivocal. And I believe that about this team. They have to get guys back. If you were to tell me, are they real or not? If it continues to be this with this MASH unit, I don't think it's real. But that's not what, you know, we expect to get Brock back. We expect to get George back. We don't know with in-season injuries when they say healthy in air quotes. I don't know what that means, but when I hear it, I expect them to be able to play at some version of themselves. And when you get these guys back and they've been able to get wins out of these guys who aren't, we don't have a whole lot of guys who are frontline players right now. But they've been able to make this team a winner. So I'm hopeful in that, you know, I'd love to see them get five or six players back, especially on the offense. I'd love to see them. I don't know what that even looks like in terms of getting a competent frontline pass rusher, because either the names that fans float are unrealistic. Like, I just don't really see why, or the 49ers giving up what it would take to get somebody like Trey Hendrickson, or why the Bengals would be, you know, at this point they've paid him, why they'd be in a rush to get rid of him. Somebody like Thibodeau who could make difference makers. I just don't see why the other team would be why they would want to make those moves. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you know, you hear people talk about players like Carl Granderson from the Saints. I mean, how much better is he really than just seeing what you have with Mykael Williams or Kalaya Davis or those type of players? I don't know, you know, but they need to do something with the pass rush, and maybe they just blitz more, which, you know, there's a lot more variance in that strategy. But yeah, I am hopeful that with health and good coaching, that this does turn to be, you know, it turns out to be something. I'm hopeful to watch. I think that Tampa Bay game does end up being a real big, you know, one of a litmus test of sorts with where we're at right now. And again, I don't know how many people are going to get back for that game, but it's going to be interesting to see if we can go in there and pull another one out.
By the way, have you heard of these great, like, as we're recording, the story came out that Mark Sanchez got stabbed.
What?
Supposedly, no. Something happened in Indianapolis where he's in the hospital and sounds like he's going to be okay. It sounds like, but the police are maybe investigating him in something, some fracas. So that's kind of, it's an early version of the story. What? I'm sure we'll hear more today. And then Diana Russini had a story in her column today where Mac Jones, before the game, that morning, so the team hotel in Marina Del Rey, Mac Jones told teammates he was on his balcony when he looked out at the water and saw a floating dead body. Somebody called the police.
What?
As the 49ers loaded buses for the stadium, players watch, investigators, and even a coroner's van pull into the marina, the incident is still under investigation. So Mac starts his day again, in which he is about to play a huge football game, by just seeing a dead body floating in the marina. That's crazy. Those stories have just been, like, people have been sending them to me as we were recording, so I just wanted to mention them as news. Last thing before we get out of here, so we talked
I'm a huge true crime fan, so that's bananas to me.
Yeah, me too. I listen to so many true crime podcasts on my walks. So Eddie Pinheiro, he's been a absolutely, I don't even know what to say, but the difference between Jake Moody and Eddie Pinheiro is like, it feels like this has been, they're going to get a win and a half or something just by making this kicker switch. When it comes to their end of the year, the smartest move that they've made, I don't know why it took them so long to do something like this. He has just given, and it's the fan base, really. It's like when he kicks, you believe it's going in. We're not quite as confident as when Robbie Gould was kicking, where we were pretty sure that dude was making it. We're not there yet. We still have, we still have to watch more of Eddie. But
still new. We're still new.
But here's the thing, right? Is Kyle hates talking about special teams. Obviously, not his favorite thing to talk about, to coach. He doesn't want anything to do with it. It's just so crazy to me why they didn't make this switch in the off season, knowing that had they done so and had they just solved it, that's something he doesn't have to worry about. And instead, they bring Moody back to start this season, and it's the biggest one of the biggest stories on the team. So much so that he kicks a game winner in preseason, and almost like making fun of the situation, they put this guy on their shoulders. Like that whole distraction of the Moody thing from this year, watching Pinheiro kick, you're just like, why did they even bother? Like, what is the flip side? Moody becomes as good as do you not want to just basically call fail on the draft pick? Like, why didn't they just do this in the off season? Like, why did we have to stretch this out to the beginning of the season? Because what we have is now a non-story, and this dude is actually making kicks to help you win games versus, is Moody going to be able to make this? Like, that's the narrative previously. And now it's like, okay, we have a reliable kicker. Let's just play football.
Yeah, that is bizarre. I guess I, to a certain extent, understand a level of pot commitment, or you invested this in him. But I think we had already gotten to the point where anytime you're dealing with a situation like that, like I've mentioned before, as a golfer, when you get the yips, it just seemed to me from the outside looking in that it was not a physical thing with Moody. And then once that's the case, I never saw it being as a situation where things were better. So, okay, now, like you say, it was like the lunacy of him making that one kick and they carry him off and they're trying to make it like, okay, we've turned the page on this, and then now we're just going to move on. And then the next week, it's a kick out of bounds and then a missed kick. It's just so that was always going to be a narrative. And I can't imagine how many points Pinheiro's presence has added and has given this 4-1 start. That there are times, I'm sure there are times that Kyle wouldn't even kick the ball that he has right with Pinheiro. That if Moody, I'm getting tongue tied, but if Moody was the kicker, I'm sure the play calling and everything else would have been a way different. With him as the kicker, and having Pinheiro and his confidence in him has just made it such a breath of fresh air. So, like you say, it's really curious why they didn't just do that. Because I mean, obviously, they were thinking about it because they brought competition, in air quotes, in. But they landed on the right guy. So ultimately, that's the most important thing.
I wonder if you were to measure the amount of unnecessary stress that Kyle Shanahan had to deal with Some of it is the Trey Lance thing not working out, but he can always kind of go back on the idea that he had to be talked into Trey Lance, right? That wasn't his instinct that was the best guy to take. Jake Moody just looking like a mopey dude on the sidelines after missing kicks, and Debo kind of pointing the finger at him like, you know, you need to shape up here. Like, I'm sure Kyle has some unnecessary gray hairs from this entire situation. And now I hope he can worry about other things, because, man, it just seemed like it was just unnecessary to have to deal with this scenario. And they put it on themselves. Robbie Gould was still kicking for them. Maybe these kickoff rules that were coming up, you know, made them think like, okay, maybe we need to find somebody else. Maybe it was Robbie Gould who was not going to bend over backwards to come back and kick. He had a certain price. He's like, look, I know how valuable I am. I could always, you know, I've made a good amount of money. I can always retire. I'm not going to take, you know, a pay cut or whatever. Whatever it was, it just seems so unnecessary. So I'm hopeful, and I don't want to jinx this because, you know, Eddie's pretty fired up. A little overly fired up for a kicker. And, you know, sometimes that can create a target from the other side. But I'm just hopeful that we're behind it. We can move on. Even if he's, you know, he's an 89% kicker historically. So I think we can live with that. We could probably live with 87. We could probably live with even a little bit less, as long as we don't have to worry about the will he or won't he, or is Kyle going to kick this? Is he not going to kick this? That is seems to be done, so we can move on. So I'm happy about that. All right, Tampa Bay, we face them next week. Do you feel like they are one of the top teams in the NFC that the Niners may have to see down the line? What is your read on this Bucs team, who is also 3-1 right now, and they play Seattle on Sunday? Might be a game to watch for 49ers fans, since we don't play this weekend. But are they for real? By the way, their wins: 3 points over Atlanta, 1 point over Houston, 2 points over the Jets, and then they lost the game to Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think they'll definitely be one of those teams, depending on how you feel about where the Niners are in terms of the playoffs. I get, you know, they've got the inside track now on being a division winner. I don't know if that holds. And if not, they definitely become one of the teams that the Niners are looking at in terms of making the playoffs. So again, a win over them would be very useful. Yeah, it's. I think that's going to be an important game, and that is one of the games that I've got circled, you know, because since the Niners don't play, it's kind of a red zone game for me. So I am interested in watching that Seahawks-Bucks game, because their offense is so interesting to me, and the way Baker is just such a gunslinger, and I'm really interested in watching Abuka. Because he's, you know, just from fantasy circles, but just to be able to watch him, and I'm really looking to see if I can find anything that, you know, how Salah is going to try to contain him, because he is a matchup nightmare, it seems, in the early going.
Yeah, I'm sure every offensive coordinator goes, okay, we're going to try and exploit the youngster, the rookie, until he, you know, plays better. Cause that's, you know, whenever you see up the back of Upton Stout's jersey, you're like, man, these dudes are just picking on this guy. So, you know, as he, I don't think, you know, he's getting real reps. So I think he's going to, you know, get better, but he's having to play a lot, and you can definitely tell they see him as one of the weak spots in that secondary. And so, you know, when teams like the Bucs, who can throw the football, I'm sure Upton Stout's got a lot of stuff to watch and to read up on, and and to prepare for in a game like this. So that'll be an interesting thing to see his progression as the season goes on. The refs are being pretty ticky-tacky with him too. Anytime he does anything, it seems like he's getting flagged. All right, so we'll be back next weekend. So next Sunday, we aren't going to go live because of, you know, my Sundays are tied up a little bit for the next few weeks. Unless it's in the morning. If it's in the morning, I can go live. But if it's an afternoon game, I cannot. So Rod and I will record sometime Sunday evening. It'll be on YouTube after we record it, and then also it'll be on the audio feed very soon thereafter as well. So, all right, man, this was a good one. I was happy that we were able to do this, and I'm glad that you are feeling better. So for Rod, I am Double G. We will see you when we see you. Peace out.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Support American-made tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.